Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Friends with Money, Money Magazine's podcast to help you earn, save, and achieve your financial goals. My name is Tom Watson, a senior journalist here at Money Magazine. And as always, it is a pleasure to be with you. As an investor in Australia, it can be pretty easy to focus on our own local share market. It's natural, right? It's what we're familiar with and what we hear about. And the same, I think, can be said for the behemoth that is the United States. It's kind of hard to escape. Of course, the world is bigger than Australia and the US, and there are plenty of investing opportunities beyond those two countries. That is why on today's episode of Friends with Money, we are going to broaden our horizons and take a bit of a dive into emerging markets. What are they? What are the risks and the opportunities involved? How have they performed in recent times? And crucially, what role can they play in someone's investment portfolio? And to help us get into these points and more, I'm very pleased to say that joining us today is Hugh Lam, an investment strategist at BetaShares. Hugh, very warm welcome to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Friends with Money.
Thanks for having me.
Hugh, before we dig into, you know, how emerging markets have performed this year, I think I'd like to kind of crack into some fundamentals first. So what exactly are emerging markets as a broad sector, and how do they differ from developed markets?
Yeah, sure thing. Emerging markets are probably, you know, referring to countries that are transitioning towards where developed markets are currently at. And those are sort of characteristics such as, you know, having a modern industrial economy, high standards of living, high income, etc. Now, they're often characterized by a few things in order to get to that place. So think of things like, you know, having fast population growth, a rising middle class. So gradually, you know, as these economies transition, they will become wealthier as their economies grow over time. There are generally urbanization trends happening as well as, you know, people within these markets move from, you know, agriculture sectors to the cities. And also an adoption of technology also characterizes emerging markets. So some of the examples and the biggest ones include China and India and some Latin American countries as well, including Brazil. There are also some Southeast Asian countries that sit within the emerging markets definition, such as Indonesia as well. But collectively, they share very similar characteristics that I just mentioned. And we can talk a little bit more about the growth opportunities emerging markets can offer, particularly for Australian investors.
Well, let's get into that, I guess, in a second. One point I wanted to ask you as well before we move on, Hugh, because we've talked about this before, and you hit me with a bit of a surprise country that's sometimes considered in the emerging market sector when we talked last, which was South Korea, right? Can you explain why they're, often put in that basket?
Yeah, so South Korea is an interesting case in study. So you're right, South Korea is characterized as an emerging market, but it does have characteristics of a developed market. I guess the key reason why is because, you know, there are, you know, some constraints as to some investment contracts that can be bought and sold in the Korean market, and also currency as well. You know, it typically you need some stability in your currency to be, you know, labeled as a developed market economy. But we saw some recent developments just late last year, actually in December, where the South Korean president actually declared martial law, and that really injected some bouts of volatility within that market. We saw the Korean won actually sell off relative to other currencies, and so those are sort of bouts that we see that are quite akin and similar to other emerging markets. So, just to recap, yes, whilst South Korea is definitely a relatively wealthy nation, some characteristics mean it's characterized as an emerging market.
So interesting. I feel like you're taking me back to my university days as well and studying international relations, but we won't get too deep into that side of things. Hugh, every asset class or I guess sector within is obviously going to come with its potential opportunities on the one hand and risks on the other. That's part, you know, of the nature of investments. Are you able to, I guess, explain to us what some of these are for emerging markets, broadly speaking, perhaps starting with the opportunities?
Yeah, sure. It's a really good question. The opportunities really come from the structural growth that emerging markets can offer for investors. So the next question is, where does that growth come from? If we kind of cast our minds back to university days, there's an equation where a large part of economic growth is determined by how much consumers spend. In order for consumers to spend, you need a couple of things. You need the population to grow. And within that population, you need more of your people to be wealthier. And that's exactly what we're seeing in emerging markets. So I'm just going to walk through a few statistics just to really set the story straight. Over 80% of the global population growth is expected to occur in these regions. And the middle class within these populations are also becoming more affluent. In India and some Southeast Asia countries, the middle class is expected to double from around 700 million in 2022 to over a billion people. So quite really stark dynamics that are happening underneath the surface. And that's good for a couple of reasons. As I said, it really increases that consumer channel within GDP. But secondly, you have local firms benefiting from that. So think of, you know, a lot of, maybe you have some stores in India that are benefiting from this trend. People are buying more goods and services. Infrastructure is being built. Digital services are another thing. And they're all benefiting the local economy. Profits are being made from that spending. And as a result, you should expect share market returns to also increase over time. So those are really the structural opportunities that emerging markets offer.
That was such a great explainer, Hugh. Thank you. On the flip side of this, and you already kind of gave us an example with what happened in South Korea last year. I feel it was longer than that, but I guess it was last year. What are the potential risks involved with emerging markets?
Yeah, I think the risks are quite commonly known actually with emerging markets, and it's a reason why I think, in my opinion, a lot of investors have overlooked this region. When investors look for opportunities in these markets, they often think about political sort of concerns, whether a certain governing body makes incorrect decisions for its nation. That is one thing. Liquidity as well. You know, sometimes the securities within these markets are thinly traded, and so entering in and out of these markets can often be costly and difficult to do. And also corporate governance. There's often institutional frameworks that are lacking in certain geographies, which make some investors a bit hesitant being shareholders of a particular company. All of that kind of leads to fluctuations in currency, which I talked about earlier. Again, you really want a stability in your currency to allow capital inflows into your market. And if you do have those bouts of volatility, then it's very difficult to attract those investments. So, I mean, those are all kind of common risks that investors find in emerging markets. But again, there are also very strong opportunities as well.
Hugh, let's get into the kind of investor portfolio side of things now. What are generally considered to be, I guess, the benefits of having exposure to emerging markets, and how might they complement, I guess, an existing allocation of Australian shares or US shares, whatever it is that an investor already has in their portfolio?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think if we take a step back and we think about what most people have within their portfolios, I think for an Australian investor, it's fair to say you might have a decent exposure to the Australian stock market. And as we know, that's quite heavily exposed to certain sectors like the financials and material sector. As a US investor, or even if you're an Australian investor with a world or global exposure, often if you look underneath the surface, there's a high exposure to the US share market. Mm-hmm. If we think about the exposure of the US market within the MSCI World Index, it's just north of 70%. So you might be holding a global exposure, but underneath the surface, a lot of that is in the US share market. Or other developed markets too. Now, that's where the benefit of emerging markets come in. Because of all those structural and very unique growth characteristics that I mentioned earlier, you know, that faster population growth, digitalization trends, urbanization, etc. These are characteristics that are not found in developed markets. Actually, developed markets face a few challenges from a productivity standpoint. There's falling fertility rates, and that's really leading to lower forecast potential growth. That is, the capacity for an economy to grow becomes lower over time. And that's what sort of Jerome Powell mentioned in his speech in the US as chair of the Fed. And so all of those sort of characteristics, it means that emerging markets do have a strong role to play from a diversification benefit. We actually looked at the correlation between emerging markets and developed markets. The correlation just effectively means, you know, how strong is that relationship to one another? It has actually fallen over time. So what that means is if you add a small allocation to emerging markets to your existing portfolios, whether that's in Australian stocks or US stocks or other developed markets, you should expect, you know, greater portfolio diversification because you're spreading your investments across different regions. So that's really where emerging markets fit in from a portfolio allocation perspective.
So forgive my ignorance here, but does that mean that, you know, for instance, when developed markets are performing strongly, for instance, developed markets are performing strongly, emerging markets might not be performing quite as strongly, and then vice versa?
Yes, that is generally the case. It's important to note that you're still invested in stocks, and stocks are, you know, part of an asset class. So you should still expect some correlation between the two. However, as you're right, there will be definitely some periods where emerging markets might perform better than developed markets. A case in point is in 2017, actually, when emerging markets actually returned around 37% in US dollar terms, whilst developed markets returned just north of 20%. So there's quite a big disparity in returns.
Wow.
We're also seeing a very similar dynamic this year, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But generally, yes, you could say that you have different periods of outperformance in these regions over time. And that's where the benefits of combining both really work.
You give me the perfect segue there. You talked about 2017, so let's talk about the kind of historical performance. Historical sounds like a strange term, given that we're only talking a few years in the past. But can you give us an idea of, I guess, how they've performed, emerging markets have performed, broadly speaking, in recent years before now, again, especially compared to developed markets?
Yeah, so emerging markets haven't really performed to the same expectations that developed markets have, let's say, over the past decade. And that's where the term the lost decade has really been coined. Emerging markets haven't really had their time in the light over that period. And it really comes down to, again, aversion around some of those risks I talked about before. But we have also seen, you know, some weaknesses in countries like China leading to underperformance in emerging markets. That's not to say that emerging markets have detracted from returns. They still have generated some amounts of returns for investors, but it's because they've been overshadowed by how much developed markets have grown over time. And again, that's really driven by really strong characteristics and growth drivers in the US. You know, everyone's talking about AI, the Magnificent Seven. Those companies have really spearheaded the bull market that we've seen over recent years in the US. But, you know, more recently, year to date, so this year, we're about 8 months in, start of September, emerging markets are now having their time in the light again. So they have outperformed their developed market counterparts by around 7%. Again, we haven't seen this since 2017. So it has been some time since emerging markets are starting to shine. And yeah, there are a few sort of reasons why there has been a lot of aversion around policy uncertainty in the US. You know, Trump has fired actually some key people in federal government agencies. So he's recently fired Lisa Cook, who's a federal governor, and Erica McIntyre, who was the Bureau of Labor Statistics just last month. So two very high profile individuals. And he's also kind of making his way into the corporate sector. So it's all becoming politicized, and investors have expressed that You know, the US dollar is quite weak now. When I say weak, I'm talking about the start of this year. It's down about 10%. And that's really because investors are looking elsewhere for other opportunities beyond the US. And that's one reason why emerging markets have become a lot more interesting this year. Again, we can touch upon some other drivers a bit later, but some countries really leading emerging market performance include China and India as the two biggest countries within that complex.
What is it, Hugh, that's driving growth in China? And then if you want to expand on India later as well, please feel free to do so.
Sure. So China's been a very interesting case study. It has had weakness actually since COVID due to the lockdowns taking place, falling property prices, weak consumer sentiment, rising debts, etc. But this year we've seen a massive turnaround actually. So, you know, the MSCI China index is outperforming the US by quite a strong margin. And that's really being led by some national champions within the technology sector. Think of companies like Alibaba, Tencent, Xiaomi. These are all companies that are performing very well. And it's because the leader of China, Xi Jinping, has really sort of put a strong focus on AI. AI is really benefiting these companies from the ground up. He's putting a lot of funding into the economy for each state to develop their own leading edge AI models. And that's really turned into strong earnings and growth from these companies. So China has seen a strong turnaround. And more recently, sentiment has picked up. A lot of local retail investors are dipping their toes back in to the Chinese stock market after years of apprehension. And that is all fueling very strong sentiment in the local market in China. So that's China. Now, with India again has a very bullish long-term narrative that's supporting their market. They've got a very young median age across their population. It's 28 years old. You know, that's very young.
That's incredible.
It's very, very young. And so again, that allows a more active participation in the workforce. And that should, you know, help drive, again, spending and growth. But similarly to China, we've actually seen India prioritizing technology and digitization. You know, Indians can now, you know, make express payments through, you know, different service providers. And there's also an identification system as well that's all made digital. So, and there's also infrastructure investment occurring across airports, bridges, and roads. And that's a very strong source of employment for the country. And then finally, there are a lot of strong structural reforms occurring at the investment level. They've announced things like the Systematic Investment Plan, which is effectively similar to Australia's superannuation program, where Indians can make fixed monthly payments into a mutual fund scheme, which again leads to purchases of stock, increasing the value of the local stock market. They have also recently announced some reforms around the GST, making it from a four-tier system to a two-tier system. Effectively, the end outcome of this is really to reduce the cost of living for a lot of Indians. Again, there is over a billion Indians in India, and so that should provide a very strong tailwind for consumer spending. So those are really factors driving China and Indian performance this year.
Fascinating, Hugh. Fascinating stuff. We've covered so much already today, but before we let you go, there's one outstanding question left, and it's a bit of a practical one. For Australian investors who are interested in, I guess, dipping their toes into emerging markets, what are their options to do so? How can they buy in?
Yeah, I think, once you've decided you want emerging market exposures, the next thing is how can you invest in it? There are so many different vehicles out there, from active funds to passive strategies. You know, what I would say as a strategist at BetaShares, although this might sound biased, is that there's actually a very strong case for using a passive exposure compared to active. There's a very conventional wisdom and truth, apparently, that emerging markets are more suited for active management because they're generally less efficient markets and you can extract alpha or outperformance from these regions. So a lot of these actively managed funds have underperformed their benchmarks, which is the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. And there's a few reasons why. What we see underneath the surface is that, you know, it can often be difficult to pick the winners of tomorrow. That is, countries that are going to grow their weights in the index over time. So what we see is that India has actually doubled their weight in the emerging markets index. And, you know, if you're an active manager who failed or was not able to capture that growth in India, you would have missed out on performance. So that's where the benefits of passive investing can come in into the fore. Now, obviously, as you mentioned, BetaShares has offered and launched a emerging markets ETF. The ticker is BEMG. Again, it aims to provide investors access to the performance of the official benchmark, the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. Now, it is a very cost-efficient exposure, one of the most cost-effective ones on the Australian market. The fees on it is only 0.35% per annum. So it's a very, very affordable exposure for many investors. If you look at other ETFs in the market, you will see fees north of, you know, 60 basis points. And, you know, there's a few reasons why for that, but at a high level, they use different approaches to that of BEMG. They use what we call full replication, which is they will buy or attempt to buy every single security within that index. But as I mentioned before, emerging markets can often be quite illiquid and difficult to trade. So that's where BEMG, which uses a slightly different structure, uses to get a more efficient exposure to that market. So that's what we have as a current offering within our space.
Well, I know our Friends with Money audience always loves a bit of ETF chat, so I think that's an excellent way to end things today. Hugh, this has been such an interesting topic. I've loved it. I, as I said, I feel like I'm back doing international relations at university, but with a bit of an investment spin on things. So thank you so much for coming on and for bringing us up to speed on all things emerging markets.
Thanks very much for having me. Cheers.
That is it for this episode of the Friends with Money podcast. But don't forget to jump on our website, moneymag.com.au, for your daily dose of financial news. Or you can go grab yourself a copy of the latest edition of Money Magazine in all good newsagents. As always, Friends with Money will be right back in your podcast feed next week. So until then, my name is Tom Watson. Goodbye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.